the headlines. Press TV sources say Iran rejects excessive demands by Europeans and the U.S. to destroy its advanced centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some nuclear sanctions. Scotland votes in a first post-Brexit election that has the potential to rock the United Kingdom over a new independence referendum. And Israeli forces arrest several Palestinians during the fourth straight night of protests against the regime's new eviction orders in East Jerusalem. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story, Press TV, has learned that Iran will not accept new demands raised by the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. The new American and European demands apparently include the destruction of Iran's advanced centrifuges in return for the temporary suspension of some JCPOA-related sanctions. Sources say the demands are against the JCPOA that calls for the stockpiling of those centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6 and IR-9 under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Press TV has also learned that there is high probability the nuclear deal, as well as the Vienna talks to revive the agreement, will fail if the West insists on its excessive demands. Sources say the new demands come as Washington has so far failed to remove all JCPOA-related sanctions. Iran is marking the 41st anniversary of a notorious attack and hostage-taking incident at the Iranian embassy in the UK. The hostage-taking in 1980 resulted in the deaths of two embassy staff. But years on after the incident, questions remain about the UK government's handling of the siege.
May 5th marked the anniversary of a six-day Iranian embassy siege in the United Kingdom. The hostage-taking took place from April 30th to May 5th, 1980, after a group of six armed men stormed the Iranian embassy in London. The gunmen were members of a separatist terror group. They took 26 people hostage, including embassy staff, several visitors, and a police officer who had been guarding the embassy. They demanded the release of prisoners in Khuzestan and their own safe passage out of the United Kingdom. Police negotiators secured the release of five hostages in exchange for minor concessions, such as a broadcasting of the hostage takers' demands on British television. By the sixth day of the siege, the gunmen were increasingly frustrated at the lack of progress in meeting their demands. That evening, they killed Sayed Abbaslav Osani, an Iranian national working for the press department of the embassy, and threw his body out. The Special Air Services, or SAS, a Special Forces Regiment of the British Army, then initiated an operation to rescue the remaining hostages, abseiling through the roof and forcing entry through the windows. During the 17-minute raid, all the living hostages were rescued but one, and five of the six hostage takers were killed. Many argued that the killing of hostage takers by SAS was a deliberate act to hide what was actually behind the siege.
Well, I think you can make that charge. I think it's really peculiar that you can kill just about everyone and then dead men tell no tales. I think that it's a situation that bears further investigation.
The hostage-taking happened just days after the Iranian embassy in London had sent a letter to the UK Foreign Secretary demanding the British government guarantee the security of the embassy building.
Well, my take is that it's very peculiar with the timing. The fact that the hostage takers traveled to Britain on Iraqi passports and would come home late at night to the apartment they rented drunk with prostitutes. So I don't think they seem to be quite the squeaky clean freedom fighters they made themselves out to be. I think there is some peculiar background to this, especially since they picked up the weapons in Britain that some people have suggested came in someone's diplomatic bag. So again, that has something to be investigated and should be looked at more closely and carefully.
A parliamentary court voted that the sole hostage taker would get a life sentence. The jail term, though, was reduced to 28 years. The man, however, was released in 2008 and is living under the covert protection of the British government. The court also cleared the SAS of any wrongdoing.
With some facts related to this incident, the siege took place by three armed men who held 20 people hostage. They were opposed to Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. Their demand the release of 91 prisoners from Iran. At the end, one gunman survived. He was given a life sentence in 1981, then released in 2008. It's reported that he's living under the covert protection of the British government.
The clearance of SAS of any wrongdoing by the British court came as the UK government even praised the special forces in their embassy response. Many argue that the siege must have ended without any of the hostage takers being killed by SAS. An independent probe team also found that the SAS operation was illegal. New Zealander director Toa Fraser also directed a movie called 6 Days, in which a new narrative was provided and the whole story was distorted.
Well, the fact that it was Maggie Thatcher's government doing this, and Maggie Thatcher was a hardliner, and she was unable to use the police to effect an end to the siege, and would not provide even some of the simplest demands that the hostage takers wanted, indicates an over-reliance on the armed forces, which she loved to do, such as in the Falklands War, which was entirely unnecessary and illegal.
The 41st anniversary of the embassy siege in the UK comes as Iranian embassies around the globe have come under attacks for over 30 times since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Iranian embassies in Canada, Australia, Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, United Kingdom, Afghanistan, Libya, and many other countries have come under such attacks. All these have been blamed on the likes of the Mujahideen-e Khalq terrorist group, which has enjoyed direct and indirect support from the West, including the United States and Britain.
Well, I think that's right. The MEK are dangerous people that bought their way off a terrorist list by bribing American politicians such as John Bolton and Hillary Clinton, who had been Secretary of State in the past. So I think that they are a terrorist group, should be treated as such, and not seen as some kind of freedom-fighting group and democracy lovers that need to be coddled.
Iran's Western adversaries stand accused of adopting double standards when it comes to the issue of terrorism. And critics of this approach say the West actually divides terrorists into good and bad ones, treating those serving its own interests, like the MKO, as good terrorists.
Unions in Greece have held rallies over government's labor reform plans that could see an increase in working hours. Demonstrators gathered in the capital, Athens, as well as other major cities to voice their opposition to the proposal. Unions have also went on strike, shutting down civil services, sidelining ferries, and halting most public transport in Athens except buses. Several flights have also been canceled due to a work stoppage by air traffic controllers. This is the second such strike by unions in a week. The government is debating a draft law to extend working hours from the current 40 hours a week. People in Scotland are voting for new parliament, results of which could impact on whether or not there is a second referendum on the region's independence from the UK. A record number of Scots have already cast their ballots, with more than 1 million having registered to vote by post. The pro-independent Scottish National Party, SNP, is seeking a majority in the 129-member parliament. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has pledged to call another independence vote if her party gets a clear mandate. On Tuesday, Sturgeon challenged British Prime Minister Johnson to take the matter to court if he wants to prevent another referendum. In 2014, Scots voted by 55% to 45% to stay in the UK, but the public opinion has changed gradually after Brexit. Correspondent in Edinburgh, Said Puraza, says economic recovery and the possibility of a second referendum on independence are the most important issues for voters.
So those two questions are really on the minds of the voters today. Who is going to lead Scotland out of the economic state it is in, brought on by the pandemic, as well as whether or not there should be a second referendum later on? The SNP has promised a referendum if it wins a majority, indeed, in today's election, when the pandemic is over, right about the end of the year 2023. A lot of the voters, 16 and above, have already cast their ballots, have chosen the mail-in system or the postal vote. But assuming that the SNP wins the majority in this election, then they're going to go ahead and carry out those plans. If they don't, then there's a possibility of a coalition being formed. If that were to pass, if they secure a majority, call a second referendum, then there will be the barrier of getting the approval, the blessing of the UK Prime Minister, of Westminster, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has already ruled out any of that happening, saying calling for a second referendum at this point in time is irresponsible.
Palestinians have gathered in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds to protest against the Israeli regime's new eviction order for inhabitants in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Troops clashed with protesters and used water cannons to disperse them, the Palestinian Red Crescent said. Israeli forces arrested near a dozen protesters. It said more than 20 protesters were also injured. This was a fourth consecutive night of protests against the expulsion order for Palestinians. An Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes by Saturday, despite having lived in Sheikh Jarrah for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the demographic character of Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinians have held an event in the Gaza Strip to hail regional and international support for resistance groups in the besieged enclave. The event was organized by Imam Khomeini Relief Committee just days ahead of the International Quds Day. Ruba Shabit reports from Gaza.
Just days ahead of the International Quds Day, Imam Khomeini Relief Committee organized an event in Gaza, which took place at a military site belonging to Palestinian resistance group Al-Mujahideen Brigades. Resistance groups participating in the event hailed regional and international support for the Palestinian resistance.
We thank all the efforts that are made to support the Palestinian cause in general and the Palestinian resistance in specific. We stress that these attempts to stand by the Palestinian resistance won't go in vain, as the resistance is improving its capabilities to defend Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
During the event, Al-Mujahideen Brigades expressed gratitude to all the countries who support the Palestinians against the Israeli regime, on top of which is the Islamic Republic of Iran that officially initiated the International Quds Day by its late founder Imam Khomeini in 1979.
On the International Quds Day, all Palestinians and Muslims all over the world make Jerusalem al-Quds their main destination for its significant historical and religious symbolism. The resistance men are here to say that we are supporting our people in al-Quds, and we are ready to fight with you. We also appreciate all the efforts made by the Islamic Republic of Iran and all the supporters of the resistance in the face of Israeli occupation.
The International Quds Day is considered a significant day to draw the world's attention to the Israeli crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian groups participating in the event hailed support for Palestinians, adding the more they hold events like this, the more they draw attention to the Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
India has recorded the highest daily rise in COVID-19 cases as the country struggles to contain the deadly disease. According to the health ministry data, more than 412,000 people contracted the coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The total number of infections in the country has now surpassed 21 million. India also reported a record daily increase in its death toll by nearly 4,000. Coronavirus has surged in India in the past few weeks. Over a new variant, the country is now facing severe shortages of medicine and oxygen supplies. Several states are under localized lockdowns and curfews, but the government is reluctant to impose a national lockdown for fear of the impact on the economy. Anti-Asian hate crime has continued to rise in both the UK and the US since emergence of COVID-19 pandemic. Ahmed Caballo explores the reasons why with this report from London.
The coronavirus pandemic has spread throughout the world, killing over 3 million and infecting over 150 million people worldwide from all different backgrounds. While the virus does not discriminate, people in the Western world do.
I was walking in the park and people might shout at me like coronavirus or something. So, but like I would say, like it's a bit unfair to blame everything on Asians.
The conceptions around coronavirus wasn't clear why it happened, so people just wanted to blame some people, and I think that's kind of unfair to like Asians.
In major cities in the US, anti-Asian hate crime has increased by 146%. And in the UK, there's been a staggering rise of 300% in hate crime against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians.
The flagrant racism of the Trump regime, Trump and Pompeo talking about the China virus and the Wuhan virus and the Kung flu and so on. All of these tropes, racial tropes related to the coronavirus that were basically about the US administration trying to cover up its own complete uselessness when it came to containing the pandemic.
But when you look at the coverage in the mainstream media outlets in both the UK and the US, it becomes clear that the demonization of China goes much further than the Trump administration.
Very obviously linked to the escalating Cold War against China. If you look back two decades, the war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, that happened at the same time as this massive rise in Islamophobia, in anti-Muslim racism, which really peaked in the early and mid-2000s, just at the time when we were destroying Muslim countries in the Middle East and Central Asia. So, of course, there's no coincidence. You know, racism is never a coincidence.
As long as Beijing continues to grow and threaten the West's economic dominance, it's likely that the UK and the US's hostility towards China will continue, which could be bad news for East Asian communities living in both countries. Ahmed Kabella, London.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
به توفیق الهی امت اسلامی و ملت مسلمان فلسطین بر دشمنان خودشون قطعا پیروز خواهند شد و خواهند دید اون روزی را که ریشه رژیم جعلی صهیونیست از سرزمین فلسطین کنده خواهد شد.
With God's grace and divine providence, the Islamic Ummah and the Palestinian nation will emerge victorious, inflicting a decisive defeat on their enemies. And we shall see the day when the fake Zionist regime will be uprooted once and for all from the land of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
امیرالمومنین علیه السلام وقتی خطبه پیغمبر تموم شد، همین خطبه شعبانیه که آخرین جمعه شعبان پیغمبر اینو گفت.
When Prophet Muhammad finished addressing his Shabaniya sermon, Imam Ali asked him, "O Prophet, what is the best deed during the month of Ramadan?" The Prophet answered, "The best deed in the holy month of Ramadan is to have piety and leave haram or unlawful deeds." Then the Prophet of Islam shed tears. Imam Ali asked Prophet about the reason for his crying. Prophet told Imam Ali, "I see a day when your beard is colored with the blood of your head in the holy month of Ramadan."
امیرالمومنین نپرسید این ماه رمضان یا چند تا ماه رمضان دیگه، چه سالی، کی، کجا، کی، اینا رو نپرسید.
امام علی did not ask in which Ramadan I will be martyred or who will martyr me or where I'm going to be martyred. امام علی only asked Prophet Muhammad, "Is my religion safe and sound on the day when I'm martyred?" The Prophet's answer was positive. Upon hearing this answer, Imam Ali said, "This is the time that I must thank Allah for His blessings upon me." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shandayati.
In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper, and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK and has been coordinating solidarity, aid and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of three-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larsen himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at three, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, about the style of the filmmaking, because the Larsen does use low-angle steadicam shots mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larsen, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, been given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden, and that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment.
Yeah,
I think it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child, but I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, oh, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And so, and it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps, that we don't know where they are, what's happening?
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to... you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically. And so this is a different way of getting the message across and poignantly. And with this three-year-old girl, and she is very, I mean, she's gorgeous to look at and very sweet and very cute and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop. And the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea, and effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, for the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think, I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, but do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of it gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
It's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to a certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. like it is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larson used the child though on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think, indeed, to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people just like you and like us, going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is, if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. Do you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, so home to some 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They're not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness and pain and fear in the eyes of the adults. But they tried to protect the children from that and, you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how, in the documentary, there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port and then... they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part, part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
Mm. And Zita, would you agree with Maria's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I could hear them speaking and, you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about, he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and, you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. You know, they're embracing their children. They're sticking together. And this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the country?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees, or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate
there. And she's three, and she will presumably integrate. But yeah, it's
perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed,
we'll just have to.
And it's scary times at the moment, and also after post-Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed. And I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now, all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, prevented the Muslims from drinking wine, for it is among the mortal sins. He, peace be upon him, said, "Indeed, the one who is alcoholic is like the one who worships the idol. Wine makes him shake and destroys his manhood. It makes him violate the prohibitions such as shedding blood and committing fornication."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the historical texts and the textbooks of the Muslims that there have been very beautiful conversations and multiple dialogues. Of course, the most interesting of these dialogues are the ones that we have received from the Messenger of Allah and the divinely appointed Imams. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, also had such beautiful conversations and dialogues with his companions and with the people in general. In some of these discussions and some of these dialogues, we find that the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir, has urged his companions to treat people according to Islamic rules of social conduct. Islamic etiquettes, if you will. We find that in one of these conversations with his companions, Imam al-Baqir very specifically tells them that a person who uses obscene language is dispraised, is disliked by Allah. And so Imam al-Baqir said, "Surely Allah detests the one who uses obscene language." Now, dear friends, it's very interesting, but this seems to happen sometimes in our lives, either when we get very angry and we end up using obscene language, somebody hurts our feelings, or somebody says something mean, or perhaps somebody uses obscene language towards us, we end up using obscene language towards them. Another instance is when we casually use obscene language. Unfortunately, it becomes a habit for us to use obscene language while we are speaking.
In both of these scenarios, we must remember that the use of obscene language is something which, as Imam al-Baqir says in this dialogue, is surely, meaning definitely, certainly, indeed. Don't have any doubts about it. Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, detests the one who uses obscene language. And of course, everything we do, everything we say is recorded in our book of deeds. And so we must be very careful as to what we do and what we say. The use of obscene language, whether it is when we are angry or when we are sad or when we are using it in casual terms, we must prevent ourselves from doing such because it is recorded in our book of ledger and we will be judged upon these things. A beautiful message for today's time in this dialogue from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
What is the method, and what are we really trying to seek and trying to know? And how is this knowledge sort of divided by our imams, by the Prophet himself? As we are aware of many of the hadiths, which I don't really want to get into it because there is a reputation, you know, a person who is knowledgeable is better than, you know, a person who sleeps and he's knowledgeable, he's better there than, you know, 70 years of ibadat, you know. You know, if a knowledgeable person is sleeping and a person who have worshipped for 70 years, his sleep is better than ibadat, right? So now, knowledge is what? Because there is knowledge where one says that al-ilmu la yanfa. That's what we recite in the Taqibat of Asr prayer. Oh Allah, do not provide me with a knowledge that have no benefit. No, Prophet emphasized that even if it be going to China, you seek knowledge. We all have, many of us have migrated here and many of us still come here to the West to seek knowledge. No doubt. Indeed, we do that. Excellent. Because the Prophet have said that seek knowledge even if we going to China. Right? But on what criteria and on what grounds? Do you think Prophet would have said that, yeah, seek knowledge, lose your deen, become worldly, become materialistic, seek knowledge, no problem, even if you have to go to China?
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.